From Brennan to the Boca Chiel, from Lummi to La Push, and from the lordly Sawduck to lovely Duckabush. From Samish to Sammamish, Suquamish to Quilicene, the climate is so friendly, it's a land that's evergreen.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 95, Seattle's Volunteer Park. Volunteer Park, located on Seattle's Capitol Hill, is an Olmsted-designed landmark park that is home to the Volunteer Park Conservatory, the Seattle Asian Art Museum, and a city water reservoir and standpipe. Volunteer Park is a massively popular destination for locals and tourists alike. Located in the heart of a dense residential neighborhood, it serves as an oasis of open space that draws tourists from all over the Evergreen State. The area that now serves as the park was first purchased by the city in 1876 for municipal uses, including for use as a cemetery, according to historical records. After being removed from the city cemetery and transported to Lakeview Cemetery, the bodies would be laid to rest for a short period of time in the park. As Lakeview Park and later City Park before being renamed Volunteer Park in 1901, it was established as a memorial to the volunteer troops who fought in the Spanish-American War. The park has played host to a variety of community activities and festivities ranging from Easter services to parades to one of Seattle's first Pride festivals, among others. As a result of the park's rich history and substantially preserved Olmsted landscape design, the Seattle Landmarks Preservation Board named the park as a Seattle City Landmark in 2010. James Coleman sold the city of Seattle 40 acres of land that would ultimately become Volunteer Park back in 1876. The exact reason for the location selection is unknown, although it was most likely because it was just north of the central city in an area that would be developed in the near future. When David and Louisa Denny platted their community just north of today's Denny Way, they surrounded the city cemetery on three sides and the property was mostly undeveloped. Denny Park was established in 1884 after the Denny family donated the area for a park. It was decided to scatter the excavated bodies among several cemeteries throughout town, including the new Washelli Cemetery on municipal grounds and the future Volunteer Park location. Noble E. Ryther was hired by the city in 1885 to clear a plot of 360 feet by 322 feet on the parcel. He charged $285 to remove all of the vegetation, including stumps and roots up to 12 inches below the surface of the ground. Soon after, the city decided to turn Washelli Cemetery into a park, and the bodies interred there were relocated yet again, this time to the nearby Lakeview Cemetery. The park was originally known as Lakeview Park, but the city renamed it City Park in 1887 because of the confusion produced by the park's two names being utilized at the same time. City Park was the city's third public park in its fledgling park system. In addition to Denny Park, Kinnear Park on Queen Anne Hill was established in 1889 by George and Angie Kinnear as a gift to the city. Realizing the importance of parks for the city's livability and its capacity to draw in new inhabitants, city leaders planned to acquire additional parkland, but they lacked both the necessary budget and an effective board of park commissioners to move that project ahead at the time. Meanwhile, as the city grew, the city council embarked on a number of other infrastructure projects, including the construction of a municipal water system. Because the system was to be gravity-fed, civil engineer Benazet Williams looked to the city's hilltops for reservoir locations when he began designing it in 1889. This meant that the water would be pushed through pipes up to the tops of Seattle's hills by the pressure created as it flowed down from the intake in the Cedar River watershed in the Cascade Mountains. The water may then be released from the hilltop reservoirs and flow downwards to the nearby homes and businesses. This type of water distribution decreased maintenance and operations costs because it did not require the use of pumps to get the water into the city or to the majority of users. In City Park, just below the crest of the hill, Williams built one reservoir and another adjacent in what would become Lincoln Park, both of which were designed by Williams. This is not the Lincoln Park of today, but rather Cal Anderson Park, which would be renamed in 2003. In this way, a close association between water system facilities and parks was established, and it has continued on to the present. It was an extremely valuable public asset, even though the park was in an almost completely undeveloped state for a long period of time. In 1892, the editors of the Seattle Post-Intelligencer expressed their excitement about the city's potential. Although it is currently in a state of uncultured virginity, it is abounding in all kinds of splendor. Not only does it provide spectacular views of the Sound and Lake Union, but it also affords access to the no less beautiful scenery to the east. At certain spots, it provides a glimpse of Mount Rainier, whose magnificence can rarely be surpassed. It is nearly magnificent to see the mountain monarch in his resplendent robes of dawn in the early hours of the morning during the summer months when the sun, which has not yet appeared, sends forth its messengers to cover him in the glorious robes of dawn. The editors went on to describe that Park Superintendent Edward O. Schwegerl had a vision for the park's transformation as an exhibition of the magnificent variety and beauty of the state flora, as well as a demonstration of the state's ability to curate plants of textile value. He believes that tobacco, rammel, and other plants with high commercial value may be cultivated, and that the development of plant life can be encouraged in a way that is unparalleled anywhere else in the world. Despite the fact that Schwegerl's concept would not be realized, the park would be partially developed. On the grounds, 5 men toiled, while another 5 worked in the nursery and greenhouse, where they propagated plants for use in all of the city parks. A keeper's house was constructed shortly thereafter, and 6.5 acres of land was cleared for construction. After receiving so much attention, the park failed to become much more than a workyard in the middle of a semi-wild terrain. Because of the ridgetop location, rainwater evaporated quickly after it rained, and there was no water supply for irrigation near the park until the water system infrastructure was finished in 1901. The Board of Park Commissioners issued a resolution in May of 1893 asking for the sale of the 41 acres, with the funds going toward the purchase of a larger and better tract of land elsewhere in the city. The proposal would ultimately be rejected by the Municipal Council, which was in charge of park purchases at the time. The Park Board attempted once more, this time stating its argument more explicitly and carefully. This was one of the provisions of its resolution. The land occupied by the city park is exceedingly high and dry, and maintaining such a large area in the middle of the city would be extremely expensive, whereas the money raised from the sale of the land would be used to purchase a much larger tract of land surrounded by Lake Washington while still leaving a surplus for future improvement projects. The city park would never be able to attract much public attention because of its isolated location and lack of water surroundings to enhance its beauty and attractiveness, so the value of the land, the cost of the improvements, and the amount of revenue that would be required for its maintenance would all be significantly higher than they would be otherwise. Consequently, the city park would be more expensive to build and maintain than it is now. According to the resolution, the Lake Washington property in question was most likely the point of land extending into the lake south of the city limits at the time, known as Bailey Peninsula, now Seward Park. This idea was likewise rejected by the city council at the time. Despite the fact that Seattle was through one of the greatest economic depressions in its history, City Park remained mostly untouched during the 1890s. The role of the Park Board and a general lack of progress in park development became a source of contention at the turn of the 20th century. Park Commissioner C.D.C. Williams expressed dissatisfaction with the state of City Park. His mocking annual report from 1897 included the following remark: "You might as easily expect to develop an electric plant in the city park by planting electric bulbs as to expect to grow roses in the city park and have them be a success." Photographs and early postcards from 1903 depict the landscaping work that was done during those years of construction. Lawns, interspersed with planting beds and individual shrubs and trees, covered much of the eastern side of the park, which was near to 15th Avenue East, where the streetcar ran along the western border of the park beginning in 1901. Following the year 1899, the development of the municipal water system accelerated dramatically. In 1900, work on the reservoir and gatehouse was well underway. The reservoir, which was designed like a rounded triangle, filled in an existing ravine that ran west from the peak of the hill. A short cast iron fence was built around the pool of water, which was enclosed by a parapet of stone. A walkway ringed the entire structure beyond the parapet's perimeter. The mechanical equipment was located in a gatehouse on the southwest corner. In January of 1901, the reservoir was filled for the first time with water from the Cedar River. In order to compensate for the loss of parkland, the city purchased 3 more acres on the south side of the park, followed by the purchase of 2.75 acres on the western side of the park. The first purchase extended the park to East Prospect Street, and the second extended it halfway into the 2 blocks adjacent to the park's western border, leaving a half-block strip of privately owned land between the park and Federal Avenue. As the city expanded northward, homes began to appear on vacant lots at the summit of Capitol Hill. According to the Moore Investment Company, which was owned by James Moore, 4 divisions of his Capitol Hill development along the southern and eastern borders of the park had been filed with the city. As a result of the vast lots, wealthy buyers began to flock to the area and mansions began to spring up all around the outside of the park. Millionaire's Row was the name given to the row of elegant residences along 14th Avenue East and makes for an awesome walk if you like to look at old houses. There are plenty of them in the area. Also in the area is the Grand Army of the Republic Cemetery, but that's a story for a different episode. Between 1900 and 1910, the city's population increased by approximately thrice. Seattle had finally amassed a sufficient number of citizens and financial resources to be recognized as a city. Strongly influenced by the City Beautiful movement, city leaders recognized that a modern city required a park system for the health and well-being of its residents. As a result, the Seattle Park Board hired John Olmsted of the renowned Olmsted Brothers landscape architectural firm to design a park and boulevard system in 1903. When Frederick Olmsted arrived in Seattle on the 30th of April 1903, the city's park commissioners took him to Volunteer Park on his first day in the city. Olmsted's park and boulevard system plan, which was approved by the city council in November of 1903, included all of the city's existing parks and connected them with a parkway system designed by Olmsted. From Washington Park, one offshoot of the proposed parkway would climb Capitol Hill, curving around the northern end of the hill and going along its western side until it reached East Highland Drive, where it would curve east and stop at Volunteer Park. Volunteer Park was included in the park system plan because of its unique characteristics, which included its location in a wealthy neighborhood and views of Puget Sound, the Olympic Mountains, Lake Washington, and the Cascade Mountains. Olmsted's recommendations for the park made the most of these features. This was an ideal landscape park because of its location in what he predicted would become a dense urban neighborhood and its proximity to downtown. It had few programmed spaces, areas designed for specific uses, but plenty of room for immersion in nature, as opposed to the forest in nearby Washington Park and rustic character of proposed parklands along Lake Washington's shore. A design for Volunteer Park was developed by the Olmsted Brothers firm, which was commissioned by the Park Board in June of 1904. The contract said that a complete set of designs, including preliminary grading and planting plans, would be provided for a fee of $20 per acre. Among the activities planned were music programs in the concert grove, promenading carriages on the concourse and carriage drive, and playing in an area designated for small ones. Olmsted's preliminary plan, given in September of 1904, included space for these and other activities. It also provided plenty of space for pondering nature, with inner vistas throughout the tree groves and outside views across the reservoir to Puget Sound and the distant mountains on the other side of the reservoir. Paths flowed across expansive lawns and among the woods, allowing strollers to soak in the beauty and take pleasure in the peace and tranquility. Plantings, in addition to the paths and drives, helped to organize the space and provide a backdrop for views. On the outside of the park, plant beds with multi-layered vegetation surrounded the perimeter, obstructing views of the streets and surrounding houses. They included trees and shrubs, as well as smaller blooming plants and ground coverings. The landscaping and flora in regions distant from the more formal concourse area, including the meandering, twisting walks, appeared to be natural, despite the fact that substantial grading had molded the environment guests were exposed to during their visit. A number of structures and buildings were incorporated into Olmsted's master plan for the park. He built greenhouses, a workyard, a shelter house with facilities, and a play area with a wading pool at the park's northern end. Along the border with Lakeview Cemetery, to conceal views of the outside world, he set up a wooden pergola and the concert grove across the concourse from the reservoir, which he called the perfect spot. Paths connected the park's pedestrian entrances at each intersection with the center of the grid. On the west side of the park, vehicles could enter through East Highland Drive, while on the south side, they could enter from 12th and 14th Avenues, and on the east side through East Gaylor Street. These vehicle entrances offered access to the carriage drive and the concourse. At either end of the concourse, where it met with the carriage, traffic circles served as anchors. In spite of the fact that Commissioner Charles Saunders advised Olmsted that the board would most likely not be able to acquire the other half blocks between the park and Federal Avenue, as indicated in his preliminary plan, the park board unanimously approved the preliminary layout. The commissioners had only recently succeeded in having a city charter change passed that granted the park board greater autonomy and responsibility, but the board did not yet have a sufficient budget to begin the process of land acquisition. Because Olmsted believed it would be inappropriate for the backyards of residential lots to face a more formal park such as Volunteer Park, he rushed to acquire the area before it was constructed with further houses. In tandem with the park's expansion, there had been an increase in efforts to link the park with Washington Park by a parkway, later named Interlaken Boulevard. After completing the parkway, which was a relatively short segment of the broader parkway system, the park board sought to garner community support for more funding for the project. Their efforts would be thwarted by the constantly rising value of real estate. Almost immediately after the first plat in the area was filed, the land value skyrocketed to such an extent that the engineer hired to lay out the parkway, George Cotterill, was forced to zigzag up the hill through less desirable land to reach the intersection of 19th Avenue East and East Gaylor Street. The parkway then followed 19th Avenue East and East Highland Drive for the rest of the way, on the east side of the park instead of the west side, as Olmsted had envisioned. In late 1905, while Olmsted was still working on the park's design, the Water Department approached the park board for advice on where to locate a new standpipe in the park to provide sufficient water pressure to homes and businesses built at a higher elevation than the reservoir. The board recommended that the standpipe be located near the reservoir. According to the park board, they turned to Olmsted, who decided on a location that was in alignment with the concourse at a point about 300 feet into the park from the intersection of 14th Avenue East and East Prospect Street, which was the site of one of the traffic circles in Olmsted's 1904 plan. The concourse was able to ring the water tower before straightening out and continuing onto the park's southern border as a result of this placement. It also served as a good vantage point for taking in the sights of the city. When Olmsted built an observatory level into the tower at the top of the hilltop, he ensured that the expansive views of the city and surrounding landscape that were then available from the top of the cleared and largely undeveloped hilltop would still be available once the neighborhood around the park began to fill in with homes and trees. It was during this time that thoughts about constructing a playground for older children began, and the standpipe was completed in 1908. Even though the original 1904 plan featured a play area for small children in the northwest corner of the park, playground proponents wished to expand the area to include space for gymnastic apparatus and other equipment, in addition to space for older children's games. To improve accessibility, Olmsted modified his grading plans and created a terrace of level land in the southwest corner of the park. During his revision of the landscape plan in 1909, he added swings and climbing equipment as well as a big slide and teeter-totters to the park. The playground was never built at that location, however, due to complaints from nearby residents to the park board about the noise the children would make. Instead, it was relocated to the northwest corner, where it would be more isolated from residential areas. The new plan also included vehicular access to 11th and 12th Avenues from East Prospect Street, which was previously unavailable. The ideas were carried out by the Parks Department, and the park was substantially completed by 1912, with the addition of the conservatory at the north end of the concourse and a set of tennis courts in the northwest corner, and a second double court would be added in 1915. At many points during the park's curation, Olmsted expressed his opinions on proposed expansions to the park. Initially, in April of 1910, the Washington State Art Association requested that a 200 by 220 foot Museum of Arts and Sciences be built in the park, either in the lawn north of the reservoir or at the north end of the concourse, between the Seward statue and the cemetery, where Olmsted had left space for a conservatory. The Municipal Plans Commission, which was designing a civic center in the Denny Regrade region as part of the endeavor to establish the Plan of Seattle, was referred the question by the park commissioners to the Municipal Planning Commission, which was commonly referred to as the Bogue Plan. In October, the commission and architect Frederick Law Olmsted agreed that it would be preferable to locate a facility with equal facilities in the civic center close to Lake Union. "The museum's intentions were admirable," Olmsted wrote in a letter to the museum's board president, John T. Heffernan, "but he could not support the institution's decision to locate a museum, particularly one of such magnitude, in a landscape park because of the negative impact it would have on the park's character and visitors' experiences." Almost immediately after the pergola and concert grove were built, local musicians began to request a new band shell that was larger and more traditional in design. Olmsted explained why such a building would be inappropriate for the pergola and advised that, if the park board felt it was required, the structure be built in the former playground space in the southwest corner of the park rather than the pergola. After much deliberation, the musicians decided on a lawn north of the reservoir for a wooden bandshell designed by Carl Gold and built by his son. It was constructed in 1915 and functioned as the park's major performance venue until it was demolished in 1947 due to decay. The park underwent its second major structural transformation in the 1930s. Judge Thomas Burke, who died in 1925, was commemorated by a plaque on the southwest side of the reservoir, which was completed in 1930. The bas-relief monument was constructed by artist Herman A. McNeil, and the surrounding stepping plazas with bench walls were planned by Carl Gold Architects. A number of other memorials can be seen throughout the park. Located on the north side of the museum is Schwegerl Rock, which was named in honor of early Seattle Park Superintendent Edward O. Schwegerl and dedicated to his memory. A plaque had been installed on the water tower in memory of L.B. Youngs, who was a significant water department superintendent in the city's history. To mark the bicentennial of George Washington's birth, a copper beech tree was planted alongside a memorial to the volunteer soldiers of the Spanish-American War near the park entrance at 14th and Prospect. Other trees were planted to commemorate Anna Kleiss, who donated her orchid collection to the conservatory and gave back to the community in a variety of ways, as well as the Grand Army of the Republic and its Women's Auxiliary Corps of the Republic of the Philippines. The Seattle Art Museum, now the Asian Art Museum, was the third structure built in the park in 1932. Because John Olmsted had died in 1920 and the Olmsted Brothers firm was not active in Seattle in the early 1930s, the city agreed to accept funds from Richard Fuller, the director of the Seattle Art Institute, and his mother, Margaret Fuller, for the construction of an art museum in the park. The Seattle Art Museum moved into the building that replaced the pergola and concert grove along the concourse. The museum had been there for 60 years before the majority of its collections were transferred to a new downtown facility. Noble Hodgson, a landscape architect, was responsible for the design of the landscape surrounding the museum, which includes the stone plaza that connects the museum to the concourse. Volunteer Park has served as a community gathering place for residents of Seattle since its founding in 1899. Musicians from all around the world performed at the Bandshell, which drew large crowds over its time. According to the Seattle Times, 30,000 schoolchildren greeted Charles Lindbergh in Volunteer Park when he flew into Seattle in the Spirit of St. Louis in 1927. From the 1920s to the 1960s, thousands of people gathered in the park for the annual Easter sunrise services. After the gold bandshell was dismantled in 1947, a temporary stage structure was erected in its stead. It hosted a be-in in April of 1967, which featured bands, dancing, and impromptu drum circles, as well as some enterprising Girl Scouts selling cookies to raise money for the organization. Volunteer Park, which would soon become the site of the annual festival, hosted the city's first Pride Parade in 1974. Eritrean Independence Day has been celebrated in Seattle's Eritrean community for many years with music, dancing, and other celebrations at a new bandshell created by landscape architect Richard Haig. In the early 1970s, Seattle Parks and Recreation hired Haig to develop a renovation plan for the park, which was completed in the following year. On the concourse side, he extended the museum plaza to the area that had been regraded to make room for the installation of Isamu Noguchi's Black Sun sculpture and its plinth in 1969. Along with the new bandstand, he devised a concept for sloping the neighborhood lawn so that it could be used as an amphitheater-like basin. He demolished one path in that area, as well as another near the Little Folks Lawn, where he planted katsura trees in the surrounding area. This area has since been revised again, with a new path added in 2013 as part of a playground renovation project. He renovated the playground and relocated the wading pool to a new location a short distance east. Haig also reorganized the park's circulation lines in the western section, which he designed. In 1972, he closed the vehicular entrances at East Highland Drive and 11th Avenue East, and he removed the spur drive from the carriage drive to East Prospect Street entirely, as well as the carriage drive itself. Just as this work was coming to a close, the park received the first of several landmark designations. The park, as well as the infrastructure supporting the city's water supply, were included on the National Register of Historic Places in 1976. The Seattle Asian Art Museum was established in 1991 after the museum relocated to its current downtown location. In 2002, the conservatory was classified as a municipal landmark, and in 2010, the park itself was declared as a city landmark as well as a national historic landmark. A few months after the park was designated as a historic landmark, members of the Friends of Seattle's Olmsted Parks banded together with neighbors and other park supporters to form the Volunteer Park Trust, which was later incorporated under the auspices of the Seattle Parks Foundation. Of its numerous achievements, the Trust works to restore the historic Olmsted landscape, which faces two challenges: the deterioration of the park's vegetation and changes to the park's infrastructure that, for example, could cause changes to the carefully balanced elements intended by Olmsted or disrupt views both within and outside the park. As part of its mission, the Trust raises awareness of the park's significance and role within the larger park system, organizes and promotes events in the park to draw people in and foster a sense of community connection, and works to discourage illegal activity in order to ensure that Olmsted's quiet hilltop oasis continues to serve the city for generations to come. In 1994, the Seattle Asian Art Museum celebrated its opening with a day of festivities that included tours, folk art workshops, performances by local dance and music groups, and more than 6,000 visitors. The addition of the new Asian Art Gallery space allowed for the display of many more of the approximately 6,000 Asian art artifacts. In 2017, the institution temporarily closed and relocated SAM's Asian art collection to its downtown location in preparation for the museum's first significant refurbishment and expansion since it opened its doors in 1933. The museum reopened on the 8th of February in 2020 with a ceremonial ribbon being cut to honor and celebrate the reopening of the art museum. During the free reopening weekend, more than 10,000 people came to see the revolutionary thematic reinstallation of SAM's Asian art collection within the renovated galleries, which was hailed as a breakthrough. The museum's curation, which is organized to highlight artistic traditions that connect cultures across Asia rather than grouping art by modern nation-states, is the only one of its kind in the Pacific Northwest and one of only a few museums in the United States that is entirely devoted to Asian art. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Doing so really helps the show to grow and to expand to a new audience, so any help that you can give in that regard will be greatly appreciated. Sources for this episode include the SeattleArtMuseum.org, HistoryLink.org, Friends of Volunteer Park, the Seattle Historical Society, the Olmsted Associates Records at the Washington State Digital Archives, the First Annual Report of the Board of Park Commissioners, the Seattle Times, and the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. Thank you for listening to Episode 95, Seattle's Volunteer Park. Episode 96 will be released next week. A special thanks goes out to Alan Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com, or you can always reach out to the podcast at its various social media pages. Thank you for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast, and until next time, I'm your host, John C.
There's peace on the Skokomish, on the Queets, and on the whole. There's calm on the Nisqually, born of ageless ice and snow. A land that nature loves so much, she stays the whole year round. I trade a royal palace for a shack on Puget Sound. There's Chimicum and Stillicum, where spouts the gooey duck. The singing Stillaguamish and the swirling Skookumchuck. And Moclips and Copalis, where the razor clams abound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound.